Montana talks here. Live and local. This is Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
Taking your calls live. 406-294-0970. Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
Oh, I'll tell you what, guys. You are going to love this guest that we have joining us here right now on Montana Talks. The 105th annual convention for the Montana Farm Bureau is underway downstairs right as we speak. They're occupying the Northern Hotel about a block away from us and the Doubletree Hotel. And, of course, we're here with our Montana Talks studios in the top floor of the Doubletree Hotel. But, you know, it was fun. I Googled the name. I did a quick search of the name Dr. Frank Mitlerner from UC Davis. And I just searched news Frank Mitlerner, and I love the headlines I'm seeing here. He's an outspoken defender of meat. An outspoken, do you get a better headline than that? I mean, in Montana, we love our beef. We love meat. And so if you're an outspoken defender of meat, well, welcome home, Doc. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So you grew up in Germany. And what, did you come to the United States, 27 years ago or so?
I did. I spent half my life here. Yes.
And now you're at UC Davis, and you focus on all sorts of environmental issues, air emissions issues, and everything. And so you're kind of pushing back on these environmental wackos, I'll call them, climate alarmists, who want to shut down Montana agriculture because they want to claim that somehow cows are responsible for climate change.
Yeah, so we do a lot of research around the impact livestock has on climate, the impact livestock has on air, and so on. And we are infusing some facts and replace fiction around these lines. And we've been quite successful that way. And that threatens some because the narrative goes the other direction.
If you were riding the elevators back down, you know, like you'll do later this hour, you take the elevator so you can head back over to the Northern Hotel where you'll be speaking as part of the convention, and you ran into somebody, a tourist in Montana, and they say, well, so what's this whole deal about cows and climate change? What would you tell them in that 30-second elevator ride?
Well, I would say that livestock does have a contribution, but the contribution it has is very different from what we normally hear. It can be part of a challenge if we don't manage it. If we do manage it, then it can be part of a solution. And that is no greenwashing. That's real, because if we focus on one gas, methane, and we reduce that gas, then we reduce warming. And we in farming can do that.
Okay. How so? What's the elevator pitch on how you can do that?
There are multiple ways. There are ways of reducing methane, and that's the main greenhouse gas from animal agriculture, via manure management. There are ways to do it via feeding, via breeding, many of those tools have been used for a long time, but, you know, let's say better breeding or so. But now we are breeding not just for yields and so on, but we can breed for low methane as well. And by doing so, have more efficient animals that produce less of this gas.
And even if so, does that still do anything to actually change global temperatures? Does it still actually do anything to impact the climate? Hold that thought. We'll take a quick break and more with Dr. Mitlerner right after this here live in studio with Montana Talks.
I'm Chad Pergram with the Speaker's Lobby. Democrats did many of the things they needed to do to potentially hold control of the House, but it was not enough. Representative-elect Eugene Vindman defeated Republican Derek Anderson in Central Virginia. Ohio Democrat Amelia Sykes hung on despite the loss of Democratic Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown. New Mexico Democrat Gabe Vasquez won re-election, vanquishing former Congresswoman Yvette Harrell in what has been the swingiest district in the country. And Democrat Marie Glusenkamp-Perez of Washington topped Republican Joe Kent. Glusenkamp-Perez was the surprise winner of all House races in 2022, the seat heavily favored President-elect Trump. In other words, Democrats seem to do many of the things necessary to gain control of the House, but not enough. Take California. It was thought that Vice President Harris atop the ticket could help Democrats flip 5 or 6 seats in the Golden State alone. No dice. Republicans held multiple seats there. This was a significant voter shift in a deep blue state, and it made the difference when it comes to control of the House. With the Speaker's Lobby, Chad Pergram, Fox News.
Securing America.
During a speech on the Senate floor Tuesday, incoming Senate Majority Leader John Thune of South Dakota was highly critical that the 2025 National Defense Authorization Act has not been brought to the floor despite passing out of committee 5 months ago.
There's never a time when we can afford to put our national defense on the back burner or underfund our nation's military.
Senator Thune adding the delay raises the importance of a study released in July by the Bipartisan Commission on the National Defense Strategy, which stated that
the U.S. military lacks both the capabilities and the capacity required to be confident it can deter and prevail in combat.
Senator Thune referenced the continuing military push by China, saying it could change the balance of power in China's favor, and that the current geopolitical climate should be teaching us a lesson.
While we never invite conflict, we have to be prepared for it.
Kevin Uretsky, Fox News.
This is where Montana talks. Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
All right. Yeah, Dr. Frank Mitlener from UC Davis here in studio. He's one of the headliners here at the Montana Farm Bureau Convention. This is going to be some very interesting conversations here this morning. So, Doc, you and I were kind of talking during the break here about how, look, a lot of our listeners are skeptical of this whole concept that somehow carbon dioxide emissions are driving the climate right now. Or even if they think, well, maybe, or if they're agnostic on it, they're thinking, okay, well, what are we actually going to do about it? Really, if you're concerned about carbon dioxide emissions, go talk to China, go talk to, you know, other countries like that that really are the drivers of global CO2 emissions increases right now. But putting that aside, you and I were talking. I was up in Scobey, Montana earlier this year, and we had the ag minister from Saskatchewan as a speaker at this event. And he was saying how, look, no matter what we think about the climate change debate, he said, look, our customers that are buying our ag products in Canada, they're coming from European countries and from other places around the world, and they're asking what our carbon footprint is. So the point being is that if you are in Montana agriculture, you kind of want to have an idea, an argument for how you respond to that type of a question. And it sounds like that's exactly what you're here talking about today. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm not talking about whether climate change is real, although I believe it is real. But that's not my topic. My topic is what contributes to it in animal agriculture and how do we need to position ourselves? How can we be part of a solution of sorts and not be part of a problem, perceived or real? You are absolutely right. If a McDonald's is saying to Canadian beef producers, from now on we only source sustainably raised beef, and all those Canadian beef producers are now caught off guard, not knowing what is expected of them, then we have a problem. The same is happening to producers in the United States, where more and more companies like Starbucks and McDonald's and Burger King and Costco and ask these same questions. What can you do, the farmer or rancher, to reduce your carbon footprint? It is the wrong approach for animal agriculture to say, look, leave us alone with that. We don't believe in it. Because the vast majority of people in this country and throughout the world are not farmers. They are consumers, and many of them, particularly the younger ones, are concerned with that topic. If your consumers demand a certain product and you say, we don't care about what you demand, then you have missed your market.
Somebody else will sell them the product instead. They'll sell, if they want organic beef and you don't want to do organic beef, well, they'll figure out a way to say, oh, well, this is our free-range certified organic beef, right? One random question I have is, we always hear people talk about the carbon dioxide emissions of livestock and, you know, production agriculture, but what about the carbon footprint of wildlife, you know, bison, elk, deer? I mean, what do they want to go out and start, you know, culling all these wildlife herds, wild horses in Nevada, simply because of carbon dioxide emissions? Why do we never hear about their carbon footprint, right?
Yeah, so first of all, when you say carbon dioxide emissions, what is really mean, meant here is CO2 equivalent emissions, and that means methane and other greenhouse gases are converted in what's called CO2 equivalent. There are these natural CO2 or carbon emitters, and among those are wildlife and volcanoes and swamps and so on. And these are called biogenic carbon sources. They are exempt from any kind of regulation, okay? The EPA and others don't care about natural emissions because they are the natural background, as they say. They can only regulate human-caused emissions, and agriculture is part of human-caused emissions. And that's why they focus on livestock and landfills and other sources of methane and other greenhouse gases.
So they've never even studied what the wildlife carbon footprint is?
No, they did study it. We know how much. It's about half of the total, let's say, methane. And methane is the main greenhouse gas that we're dealing with here in animal agriculture. About half of that stems from natural sources, the other half from man-made sources, such as oil wells and cattle and landfills and so on.
So when it comes to the carbon footprint, the methane footprint, carbon footprint equivalent, however, from production agriculture in America compared to all other sources, what do you think is the most important information for Montana farmers and ranchers to know?
So first of all, what you oftentimes hear, that livestock is a main contributor of greenhouse gases, that needs some nuance, okay? If you look at the emission inventory for the United States, then livestock shows up as producing 4% of all greenhouse gases. So 4% is the number for the U.S. for all livestock, and that's beef and dairy and everything else. Beef alone is around half that. So about 2%, maybe 3% of all greenhouse gases in the United States stems from beef. And as I said, 4% of all livestock. So you could say, well, that's not very much. Well, if every source would say we are not very much, then nothing would happen. So while it's not very much, we can still make a difference by adopting some of our practices, like we always have. Okay, we have always improved efficiencies. We've always improved productivity. That always has had an impact on the environmental footprint. So, for example, we are producing 18% of all beef globally here in the United States. 18%. And we are doing that with 6% of the global beef herd. That just tells you something about efficiencies. We are world champions in that. This last year, I visited 26 countries throughout the world. 26. All Latin American countries, many European countries. And the reason why is because governments and parliaments in these countries wanted to know, what do you do in California that makes these reductions happen?
That's very interesting. Well, hold that thought. We'll come back to that after the break. Yeah, that's another reminder of, okay, if you don't like the carbon footprint of beef production in America, how much bigger do you think that footprint would be in other parts of the world if they weren't doing it as efficiently as we do it here?
Media Minute with Howard Kurtz.
It's the first rule of Washington journalism. If there's a confidential document out there, somehow it will leak to the press. Well, now comes the news, first reported by ABC and details from the New York Times, that an unidentified hacker has obtained sworn testimony to the House Ethics Committee and apparently plans to make it public. This had to do with a civil lawsuit filed against former Gates associate Joel Greenberg, a convicted sex trafficker now in prison. So 24 exhibits, sworn statement from a woman claiming she had sex with former Congressman Gates in 2017 when she was 17 years old. Another woman corroborating the account, claiming to have witnessed the encounter. Also, we learn that Donald Trump is making calls on Matt Gates's behalf, despite the fact that he knows he's likely to lose. With your Media Minute, Howie Kurtz, Fox News.
What a lineup for Tuesday's Montana Talks. We had John Jackson, the Joker, in the house, plus a drop-in by Senator-elect Tim Sheehy just after he spoke to the Montana Farm Bureau. He spent several minutes with us, and the General Counsel for the American Farm Bureau joined us on Tuesday's Montana Talks as well. Coming up on Wednesday, we are going to talk judicial reform with a lawyer who serves on the committee in the Montana Legislature. So that's coming up Wednesday's Montana Talks, 9 to 10.
This is where Montana talks. Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
Yeah, that is pretty funny. The New York Times, they're basically trying to say that this Dr. Frank Mitlerner, oh, he's too close to agriculture. He's too close to agriculture, but you know, talking with Dr. Mittlerner during the break here, he's like, look, ag has a great story to tell here on this very topic. You know, Doc, you just mentioned how, let's see, what is it? 18% of all the beef supplied globally is produced here in the United States, but we only have 6% of the cattle herd globally. But that shows how much more efficient, how much better we are at producing that type of product to feed people globally in a much more efficient manner. And so, anyway, pick up where we left off on that topic.
Well, that's absolutely true. And we are world leading in this field, and we have been for decades, but we are also world leading in not telling our story. You know, we can be as good a farmer as you can be, but if you don't talk about it, then you're the world's best kept secret, and that's it's time to change that. I recently read a report by the world's leading body on climate. It's called the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, IPCC. And they estimated that 80% of global livestock emissions occur in developing countries of the third world. So, for example, India and Brazil, these two countries, have more cattle than the rest of the world combined. And they're producing, particularly India, but also many African countries, a dismal amount of product with vast herds, okay? And we know how to change that. We have shown it here in the United States and other countries. It's time for that technology, for that knowledge to be shared throughout the world, because if we don't do that, then livestock globally can really have a significant footprint.
Yeah, so the point being is that if you're somebody who cares about this whole carbon footprint thing, right? Again, no matter where you sit on this topic, if you're somebody who cares about this whole carbon footprint thing, or if you're a customer or something like that, the fact is the United States beef producers, our ranchers, have a much lower carbon footprint than everywhere else in the world when it really comes down to it. So, which would, of course, get us all to ask the question, well, why do they keep trying to put a target on the backs of American producers then, of course, right? Sustainability. I know some of these buzzwords, they really drive, you know, us nuts. And I've heard from some ranchers, and they'll even say, why does the Montana stock growers, why do you hear them use this word sustainability? It's because, again, they're marketing their product to their customers, and they're using the left's own terminology against them. That's how I kind of see that. But what's your take on why people, even within the industry, will use the buzzwords from the other side?
So this discussion has been with me for my entire career, okay? So before I talk about sustainability, I want to talk about something else, stewardship. If you hear the word stewardship, are you opposing to that term when it comes to your operation? Most farmers and ranchers would say, no, I endorse stewardship. So what does stewardship mean? Stewardship means that you want to be the best steward of your land, meaning the soil, the plants, the water on your premises, the air. So that's environmental stewardship. You want to be the best steward of your animals. Best health and welfare of your animals is very important to you. So that's animal welfare. Then you want to be the best steward of the products you produce, product quality, product safety. Then you want to be the best steward of the people who work with you, the workers. And finally, you want to be the best steward of the financial resources you have. So again, that's environmental quality, it's animal welfare, it is food safety, it is workers and financial viability. These are the five pillars of stewardship. And every farmer and rancher I've ever met said, I'm endorsing those five pillars. Guess what? Sustainability is the exact same thing.
It's really just about how you market and package what you're already doing to a certain extent.
Yes, but in the countryside, people go for the term stewardship. In cities, they don't know what that means. They use the term sustainability. If people in cities who buy your products like that term and request it from you.
So oftentimes we're talking about the same thing. We just use different words, different language. You know, you grew up in Germany. Maybe there's a German word, but we're using an English word, but we're really saying the same thing.
We're saying
that's
the same thing.
Concept here. It's this urban-rural divide, and this is just about marketing to that urban crowd. You said three key words. So again, for those who who are trying to target this lower carbon footprint crowd or type of customer or certain country in particular, there's three key areas where you can actually figure out a way to lower that methane footprint, whatever you want to call it. Feeding, breeding, and manure management. I guess tell us in each of those three categories how they can do so.
So on the breeding side, methane is a heritable trait. The mama cow passes it on to its calf. And so we can now identify whether an animal is a high or low methane producing animal and select accordingly for breeding purposes. There are feed additives that we can use to add to the ration of animals in feedlots, let's say, or on dairies.
Or the supplements even already?
Supplements too, yes. And we are researching them as we speak to find out what works to suppress methane production. And last not least, there are manure treatments. If you collect manure like dairies do, like some feedlots do, then you can collect the gas and make it into fuel for heavy-duty trucks and vehicles. These three tools, feeding, breeding, and manure management, have allowed the dairy industry in California, which is the strongest in the nation, to reduce its carbon footprint drastically. We have to reduce 40%, 40, of methane by the year 2030. Our dairy industry is on track of achieving that goal, which is the most aggressive in the world.
How much did it cost, though, and then how much does that end up driving costs for the consumers up?
That's a good question. How much does it cost? Well, first of all, we have what's called an incentive-based approach, and that means we have those industries that cannot reduce emissions pay into an account, and from that account, people who can reduce emissions get paid. Our farmers are those who get paid. And so it's either cost neutral or cost positive to them to implement these techniques.
So when it comes to feeding, breeding, and manure management is, hey, maybe we capture the methane coming off, just like some landfills will use the methane coming off of trash to create gas, similar concept there. Feeding and breeding, so basically are you telling us that you can breed a less gassy cow and you can feed a cow to be less gassy, just like some people, based off of what they eat, they might be a little more gassy too?
Yes, except for in the case of our rumen, the gas doesn't come from the back end. It comes from the front end. It's burped out, okay? So yeah. What you and I do is one thing. What cattle do is another thing.
Yeah, very interesting. The other big picture to me is, I remember we had a great conversation with Brian Massard, who's got Reminis Angus out of Dillon, Montana. And he was making the point that, look at how good animal production agriculture is for the environment, period. People are trying to calculate the fuel that you use driving around checking on your cows, or the fuel that you use, you know, harvesting and seeding those crops. He says, but look at all of this space. Look at all of this open space that I've preserved. Look at the bugs that are rising up above the earth in the spring. Look at the plants. Look at the open grasses that are consuming that carbon dioxide. And look at this rangeland that is being preserved because of us. Shouldn't that be a factor here?
It should be a factor, and currently it's not. What you're referring to is biodiversity, okay, that we are aiding biodiversity by adding nutrients, let's say, to the soil, stimulating microbial growth, stimulating forage production and so forth, stimulating a variety of wildlife that lives because of us preserving natural landscapes. That's biodiversity. The other thing is soil carbon sequestration, okay? That is a very important process that sucks carbon out of the air and stores it in the soil. And rangeland, ranchers on rangeland are the number one source, or number one sink, I should say, number one sink of carbon in the nation.
In terms of they're helping to lower the carbon footprint because they're keeping the rangeland open to be able to do just that. I mean, there's this bumper sticker. You've probably seen it in California too. Cows, not condos. And we see a lot of good productive agricultural land that's getting tilled up and turned into developments for housing because the cities make it too hard to build housing inside of town. And so then the builders have to build outside of town. And then this good ag land gets chewed up. And it's like, well, shouldn't these liberal cities be punished for what they're doing to take out this this land? I, you know what I mean? It's just like so many of these arguments are so absurd that they don't want to focus on what actually helps the environment. Instead, they want to attack the people that actually help the environment, like the farmers and ranchers.
So I don't want to comment on the politics, but just from a standpoint of land use impacts, we have studied 70 different land uses in California, 69 of which were agricultural, and one was urban encroachment. And that's what you're referring to. No place in the country has more urban encroachment than California. And what we found was that the urban encroachment, so recently built residential areas, are 70 times more impactful on the environment than even the most environmentally impactful agricultural practice. So 70 times more negative than any agricultural practice ever would be. But these are voters and these are taxpayers, and therefore the blame will not go onto them or against them, but to our friends, the farmers and ranchers.
Well, this has been so great to get a chance to catch up with you and hear your insight here. What time do you, Dr. Frank Mitlerner, what time do you speak at the Montana Farm Bureau Convention, or did you already speak earlier this morning?
No, I will be the keynote speaker after lunch.
After lunch. Okay. Well, I know folks are going to be looking forward to hearing that. So thank you so much for freeing up some time to come up and see us.
You're most welcome. Thanks for having me.
You got your elevator pitch ready if you run into people on the elevator now, too. Well, Doc, this is great. We'll have to get you back on again, even over the phone, when you're back home at UC Davis. So that's a great topic. All right, quick break here on Montana Talks. It's now been confirmed by the Department of Homeland Security. The violent Venezuelan gang Trende Aragua is in Montana. A retired Homeland Security agent joins us right after this.
This is where Montana talks. Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
All right. Yeah, I just saw this news break yesterday, and I thought, you know what? I already got my two articles for the day that I produce for our Montana Talks website. And, of course, we're able to gather content from other content providers across the state as well. But I thought, oh, this is big. I got to get this on our Montana Talks website right now. It's now been confirmed by the Department of Homeland Security that Montana is one of several states that the violent Venezuelan prison gang known as Trende Aragua is now operating in. Now, I'm sure many of you are shocked, but certainly not surprised. I mean, we've already had the Mexican drug cartels operating here in Montana because of our wide-open southern border. And when we saw the news that TDA, Trende Aragua, was taking over entire apartment complexes in the Denver, Colorado area, we knew if they weren't here yet, they were not going to be far behind Aurora, Colorado, because that's only about a 7-8 hour drive from Montana's largest city of Billings, Montana. But anyway, when this news broke yesterday, I thought, man, we got to get somebody to join us on the show who can talk about Trende Aragua, who can talk about this. Who should we talk with? And then I saw Charles Marino on Fox News. Charles Marino is an internationally recognized national security expert, a former executive with the United States Secret Service, and senior advisor to the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, now with us. Charles, thanks for being with us. Appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thanks for the invite.
So Trende Aragua is now here in Montana. Initial thoughts from you?
Well, like you said, not surprising. We predicted at the start of this crisis that every state would eventually be impacted, not just in the surge of illegal migrants, but everything that came with it. And the fact of the matter is, with 10 to 15 million unvetted migrants that have been allowed into the country, we knew that some elements were going to be criminal in nature, terrorists in nature. And we've seen examples of both, whether it's a resurgence of MS-13 out of Mexico or Trende Aragua out of Venezuela. And now states are starting to deal with this. And if you look at the initial setups with Montana, your state being one of 16 identified in that DHS bulletin, They are setting up in a regional approach throughout the United States. Their goal is to ultimately make money, so their expansion will continue, especially in the remaining months of the Biden administration, where no significant policy changes will take place. So Trende Aragua and other criminal elements will continue to become a larger portion of the population. And with that, we'll see more encounters between these violent gangs and the American public.
And, of course, a lot of Montanans are now already familiar with TDA, with Trende Aragua, because of these shocking videos out of Aurora, Colorado, where they were taking taking over entire apartment complexes. And then, of course, some of the folks on the left were downplaying this. Oh, it's only a handful of apartment complexes. It's like, good night. So describe TDA, what they do, how they profit off of this illegal. I understand they, according to this New York Post story, they start with kind of lower level fraud and theft schemes, but then they turn into human trafficking, sex trafficking, drugs, and then don't they basically potentially get into full blown war with the drug cartels? I mean, could we end up seeing something like a drug war, a gang war between Trende Aragua and the Mexican drug cartels right here in Montana?
Yeah, and I'll add another element. How about in a war with law enforcement authorities and the U.S. government under the Trump administration as they move to rid the country of these dangerous elements? As far as the crimes that these gangs are involved in, it really comes down to anything that they believe they can make a profit in. So it's everything from traditional fraud to lower-level retail thefts, to violent brute force burglaries and robberies. So anything, and most of this money, by the way, is sent back to Venezuela, leaves the United States. So anything that they can make money on, that's what they're going to be involved in. And ultimately, many of these encounters, will turn violent for American citizens. As far as some of the challenges ahead, we look at these sanctuary cities. You brought up the left. The fact of the matter is we're hearing a lot of tough talk come out of these sanctuary cities right now. But they really have no power over this issue other than preventing their law enforcement from working with ICE, which is unfortunate. But ultimately, this is a federal law, a federal crime. It will be handled by ICE, and we will see ultimately a surge of federal resources go into these sanctuary cities who harbor these criminals and suspected terrorists.
In Montana, and I don't know if you've been to Montana before, but, Bozeman, Montana, Big Sky Country, Gallatin County, et cetera. I mean, we've just had a number of individuals end up in our jails, sexual assaults, drugs. Recently, there was a guy shooting at the police in Belgrade, Montana, which is just outside of Bozeman. He was shooting at the police. Well, he's in jail on an ICE hold right now, and they're from all sorts of countries, Mexico, other Central American, South American countries. But I just wonder how much of a presence TDA might have in the state.
Yeah, you don't know what you don't know. Usually it's led by encounters. So that's where ICE's interior operations and intelligence units will work to answer exactly that question. But what you just described with those in the country illegally that then go on to commit additional crimes that are identified in the jail, put on an ICE detainer, that's exactly the way the system should work. That's what we're missing in these sanctuary cities. And since they're not complying, I've been advocating for just completely cutting off the federal public safety grants that these states get from DHS and the Department of Justice, and surging that additional money to the states that are cooperating with ICE. There needs to be repercussions here for these states that are not only protecting very dangerous people, not doing the right thing by their citizens, but also really sticking their thumb in the eye of law and order. And so we have to resolve that. As you know, the power of the purse gets many minds to change. sometimes. And so I think what you're going to see under the Trump administration is a lot of tough diplomacy within the United States with these states that just don't want to play ball with this. And they're going to find out that whether they're a part of it or not, it's going to happen. But we need to continue to work very well with states like Montana that are going to be complying and working closely with the additional ICE resources throughout the interior of the United States. Because let's not forget, under the Biden administration, there hasn't been any interior enforcement.
And they've been actively
like
blocking.
Turned into processors.
And they've been actively blocking our local officials. We've got a governor and an attorney general and sheriffs and police chiefs who want these criminal illegal aliens deported, but they will stand in the way of those efforts. Now, on the flip side, we're going to have a Trump administration that will be on the same page as our local officials. So what can our local law enforcement and others do to support efforts to go after TDA, the drug cartels, and others?
You know, one of the things that you may see is a re-implementation of programs like Secure Communities 287G, which streamlines the process for state and local law enforcement and ICE to really deport more rapidly, more seamlessly for those that should not be in the country and have been identified as a threat to the community. So you're going to see a lot of programs, a lot of policies come back from the first Trump administration that's going to be used to make local law enforcement more efficient and not be bogged down in this issue. It's a very successful program, by the way, I should note, used by both the Obama administration and Trump administration. So this is a tool that was viewed by both Democrats and Republicans at one time that made a lot of sense to remove these criminal and national security threats from the country. So, you know, I think the best is for local officials to work very closely with their ICE offices in their states. There's going to be task forces put together. I have no doubt about that. So I think there's a lot of work to do. We're talking about large numbers here, but we're ultimately talking about a prioritized approach by the Trump administration to get those urgent threats out of the country.
And hopefully these intelligence fusion centers at the state level are up and running.
That's
and you've
right.
got all the agencies sitting at the table to share this information to figure out how to go after the threat across the board. Hey, I got to take a quick break here, but I'll tell you what, Charles Marino, a former advisor to the Department of Homeland Security, if you can, stand by and we'll come back to you right after this. But if you got to run, we understand as well. A quick break back after this.
Your morning cup of Sean. This is the Sean Hannity Morning Minute.
The DA's office did propose December the 9th as the deadline for their upcoming filing, which will, quote, consider the possibility of dismissing the case. Judge Mershon was slated to decide today whether a Supreme Court ruling grants Trump immunity from prosecution, and it does. And they had testimony from the time that he was president that was brought before that jury. This case is done. It is cooked. It is over. It is finished. The only reason Alvin Bragg would want to keep it alive is because politically he's in an elected position, is that liberal New York City would like that he's persecuting Trump.
The conservative underground meets later today on the Sean Hannity Show.
When you're hiring for your business, ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology makes finding qualified candidates for your job easy. This made us wonder, what if the rest of the world was as easy as ZipRecruiter? Math problems wouldn't be so problematic.
K = 42.
Escape rooms? Elementary. And summiting Everest would be a walk in the park. In the meantime, if you want to make your hiring easier, use ZipRecruiter. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/free. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Simple. So, see what the world is like when ZipRecruiter does the hard work of hiring for you. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/free to try ZipRecruiter for free. Once again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/free. ZipRecruiter.com/free.
This is the Montana Economic Minute.
Population movement has been at the core of American history for centuries, yet many of us profess to be unhappy about it. To judge from the propaganda of political ads, those who stay put are to be celebrated, while those who have arrived elsewhere are not. Of course, the data show that roughly half of Montanans were born in other states, which makes it quite likely that many of the folks producing those cynical ads were born somewhere else as well. But behind these crude sentiments is the notion that new people, immigrants if you will, bring costs that those of us who already live here must bear. And that, as it turns out, is a question that lends itself well to analysis. Most of the research says that new residents add to the economic pie, especially when you take a longer view over second and third generations, and even more so with the tight labor markets of today. The worst-case scenario, a new low-skill immigrant with less than high school education, can have more cost than benefit, but if their arrival helps a business expand, the cost disappears. I'm Patrick Barkey.
Every home should be warm and cozy.
Brought to you from the Hot Spring Spas and Hot Tub Company, Friends Recommend Studio.
This is where Montana talks.
Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
All right. Thankfully, Charles Marino was able to stick around for just a few more minutes with us here as we get to the shortest segment of the hour. But yeah, Tren de Aragua has already set up shop in these 16 states. Homeland Security warns. That was the headline from the New York Post yesterday. I've got a full story on our Montana Talks website right now. Charles, you know, I mentioned this to you during the break. You know, I did over 100 events traveling all across Montana over the past, you know, 9 months or so. And I'd be set up at coffee shops, cafes, grocery stores, hardware stores. And so I talked with a lot of people. One of the things I found very interesting was there's a number of these Uber Eats or other food delivery drivers, right? Like it just amazes me how many people will spend all that money to get their food delivered now, because it's like food's expensive anyway, and then you're paying more to get it delivered. But I was amazed at how many Venezuelans that were working as these food delivery drivers that I came across. Now, just because they're from Venezuela, of course, I'm not saying that means that they're TDA or Tren de Aragua, but I was amazed at how many Venezuelans, period, are now in Montana.
Yeah, you know, ultimately, we've encountered 180 different countries at the border that have made their way into the United States. So you're going to see diversity of what you just described around the country, wherever they were settled. But what I can tell you is nothing is off the table. And a lot of people, a lot of private companies are going to be reminded that there are immigration laws in this country under the Trump administration. So while we spoke about prioritizing to those threats for removals, you're also going to see visa overstays be addressed. You're ultimately going to see those that fail to show up for their immigration hearings. And you're also going to see a focus on what I would say is workplace enforcement, something along the lines of the E-Verify program, where companies are supposed to validate the legitimacy and the work permits of those that are in the country. And that's just not being done. For some reason, a lot of these companies have followed suit that, look, if the administration under Biden is letting everybody in and doesn't care, why should we care? And that's going to change. So you're going to have a lot of worksite enforcement operations, I predict, that also are conducted throughout the country.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, because I know there's incredible, you know, on-the-ground FBI agents, Homeland Security agents, Border Patrol agents, you name it, that they are just as frustrated as the rest of us of what they've seen take place with this invasion of our country in these last 3.5-plus years, and they're ready to get to work. And once Tom Homan and others get on the job, I think we're going to start to see some swift action. About a minute to go before we run out of time. Again, Charles Marino, great to have you on the show. Anything else you want to tell our listeners across Montana?
Well, you know, when you talk about the morale of law enforcement, especially ICE and CBP, let's remember that for the past 4 years, we've seen an administration implement policies that have directly undercut our entire homeland and national security apparatus. So think of it this way. Everything that was put in place in the aftermath of the attacks of September 11, 2001, were being undermined by what the Biden administration was implementing in terms of policies and ultimately allowing to happen. And that's why these law enforcement agencies were frustrated, because their jobs were being made 100 times harder by an administration that should have been supporting them with policies that enhance their abilities to keep the country safe. We should not see the crime rate in our country skyrocket while the crime rate goes down in places like Venezuela and El Salvador and Guatemala, and the list goes on and on.
Great point.
Because they're sending their worst to the United States.
Great point. Well said. Charles Marino, thanks for your time.
Fox on set.
What if Google Chrome was no longer part of Google? The U.S. Justice Department is reportedly ready to ask a judge to force Google's parent company called Alphabet to sell off the company's prized Chrome web browser. The browser, which is free to users, is how the DOJ says Google reinforces its monopoly on internet searching. A court already ruled that Google is a monopoly. Google tells Fox Business the DOJ is pushing a radical agenda and that government is putting its thumb on the scale in ways that will harm consumers and American tech leadership. But who could actually buy Chrome? One of Google's competitors, perhaps. Rumble is a video platform that competes with Google's YouTube service. Its management has long argued Google's search algorithms have worked to sideline Rumble content. Now its CEO posts on his X account that Rumble is ready to buy the Chrome browser property from them. With Fox on Tech, I'm Evan Brown, Fox News.